So who's the new rabbi and what's his story? Here's my story. 30 years ago, I was like what many of you tell me you are. Yes, I went to Hebrew school for the absolute minimum necessary to become bar mitzvah. I then didn't go into a synagogue for about 20 or 30 years. I was dragged to school, sort of, and I inflicted Hebrew school on my children as a form of intergenerational revenge. I couldn't get back at my parents for dragging me to Hebrew school, but by God, I would force my kids to go to Hebrew school. And something I never understood, they actually liked it. Very strange. But when I moved to Southern California about 30 years ago, we joined a Reform synagogue, and I met a rabbi that was nothing like any rabbi I had ever met before. First, this guy was younger than me. I never thought that was possible. Second, he had a sense of humor, and he seemed to be open to questions. The rabbis that I remembered from my youth were these little old men who made you feel guilty about all the things that you did and all the things that you didn't do. So he joined the synagogue. He is now retired, and I'm not. And he taught an Introduction to Judaism course, and I really got hooked. So the rest is history, resulting in this opportunity to serve you. But I can never forget the lingering questions in my mind. What is going on here in synagogue, in Judaism, in high holidays? Can I really believe in God, knowing what I know about science? Many of you know that I'm a physicist by training, and I haven't been officially kicked out, so I think I'm still a physicist. I worked most of my first career in physics and alternative energy development. I'm not, I would say, and would still say, going to keep strictly kosher, strictly observe Shabbat, all the laws of Pesach. What's the point? What's the point in raising my kids Jewishly? Why go to synagogues? Why come to the high holidays? Why worry about this, what seemed to me like superstitious nonsense? I grew up in a very Jewish family. I knew lots of Jewish stuff. Yiddish expressions, been locked to many seders, but didn't really know some very simple things. What's the point of Judaism? Who is God? What does God want from the world? What does God want from Jews? What does God want from me? What kind of God would want us to mindlessly recite this liturgy, same liturgy, over and over again? Why did the rabbis of my youth only succeed in making me feel guilty and driving me away from them? So here's Judaism 101, the answers to some very basic questions from our tradition's perspective. Why did God create the world, humans, and Jews? First of all, don't worry about whether God exists. Judaism assumes that God exists. Most people, when asked, will say they believe in God, but I think it's most people, when asked, would say, yes, I believe in the South Pole. The question is not whether you believe that God exists or whether you believe the South Pole exists. The question is, how does it affect your life? Intellectually, most of us are agnostics. We have some doubts. We're not sure. But you can't live your life as an agnostic. Most of us believe in God, but live our lives pretty much with no influence of God upon us. For me, in religion, there are two leaps of faith. And I absolutely call it faith and not knowledge. I will often say, I know this pen exists. I don't have faith that the pen exists. I know this pen exists. But I have faith that God exists. And for me, there are two leaps of faith. First is in the existence of God. Is everything just a random accident, or is there some kind of organizing intelligence to the universe? I'm here to tell you, as a scientist, while I don't believe that there is proof of God's existence, I believe that there's an extraordinary amount of evidence for God's existence. And tune in to other high holiday sermons, not this year, but in the future, for details thereof, or, you know, maybe we'll have a class, or sometimes it's hard to get me not to talk about that, but I'm going to control myself. But that's leap of faith number one. I actually think that's a pretty easy leap of faith, that there is something going on here that's not just scientific randomness. the leap of faith that's actually more difficult is this God who created the laws of physics, who set everything in perfect balance, does this God really care whether I have turkey or ham? Does this God really attempt to communicate with us? Does this God care whether we're nice to one another or whether we torture one another? The God of the philosophers was spoken of as the unmoved mover, a God that truly didn't care. Judaism holds, and most of our religions hold, that God is a God that cares passionately about us, about how we behave to one another especially, and attempts to communicate with us through sacred literature. I'm often asked about doubt and whether doubt is okay. I'm here to tell you I believe that doubt is not only okay, I believe I can prove it, and I believe it's part of the divine plan. First, on one level, you've heard of the word Israel, yes?
Yes.
This is the interactive part of the sermon. In Hebrew, Israel is Yisrael. The word Yisrael enters our tradition, enters the Bible, when Jacob, the heel, Jacob's name is actually is Yaakov, the heel, gets his name changed. He wrestles with an angel, also understood to be God, all night long, is about to be, the sun's coming up, the angel says, let me go. Jacob says, no, I won't let you go until you bless me. He says, what's your name? My name is Jacob, Yaakov, the heel, because he was holding on to his brother's heel when he was born. He said, your name shall no longer be Yaakov, but Yisrael, because you have wrestled with beings human and divine, and you have prevailed. So people come to me and they say, Rabbi, I have big problems with God. How could God allow this to happen? And, you know, you fill in the sentence. We all have a sentence like that. And my answer is always, welcome to the club. We not only hold that it's okay to wrestle with God and be angry with God, we name ourselves God wrestlers, Yisrael, one who struggles with God. But notice that you can't struggle with something that you don't believe in. If there's no God, there's nothing to be angry about. So why do I think doubt is okay? And why do I think the Bible proves that? Consider the generation of the Exodus. That generation, and by the way, it doesn't matter whether you believe the Bible or not. This is our sacred story. Consider what our sacred story is teaching. The generation of the Exodus saw some amazing miracles. The 10 plagues, manna from heaven, the sea splitting, and they get through. Good miracles, yes?
Yeah.
Thank you. That generation, Moses goes up to the mountain. He is one day late coming down. And Moses' brother, the high priest, creates a golden calf and says, this is the God. The people worship the calf as the God that brought them out of Israel. So if all those miracles couldn't eliminate doubt from that generation, how much more so ourselves? Now, why do I think doubt is a good idea? I believe doubt is necessary for us to have free will. Consider, you're driving along the 101 freeway on one of those rare moments where it's not completely overcrowded, and you're going at the unofficial speed limit of 72.5 miles an hour. Children, I never said that. And all of a sudden, you see that you're slowly overtaking a highway patrol car. Now, in theory, you have free will to zip on by the highway patrol car, maybe beep a few times and thumb your nose. In practice, you don't have free will. In practice, if you know you're going to be punished and rewarded with certainty, you lose your free will. The Talmud says everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear or awe of heaven. If we are truly to be free agents and have free will, we have to have some doubts. I suggest it's okay to have doubts, but don't let those doubts interfere with your relationship with God. Rosh Hashanah is the anniversary of creation, so let's look at creation. People will often... Christians of goodwill are out to get us from time to time, and they're out to get me, and they're out to convert me, and they say, just read the Bible. So let's read the Bible a little bit. The opening phrase of the Bible, Bereshit bara Elohim, usually translated as, in the beginning, God created. But the interesting thing about that opening sentence is, it contains between word number 1 and word number 2 a grammatical error. Breshit is half of an expression. It's michut, if you know Hebrew grammar, or a construct form. It requires a noun. It literally means in the beginning of. But the second word of the Hebrew Bible is a verb. So if I were to try and translate it literally, it would be in the beginning of God created the heavens and the earth. So there's a couple of possibilities. One is that God didn't understand Hebrew grammar and made an obvious mistake between word number one and word number two. You can be pretty sure the rabbis rejected that as an idea. The second is God was trying to teach us something. And what the rabbis suggest God was trying to teach us is that we have to interpret. You can't simply translate. You have to dig into the text. In this way, we Jews are very into commentary, something we share deeply with the Catholic Church, also very into commentary. So it's perhaps, if most Jewish translations don't say, in the beginning God created, but say, in the beginning of God's creation. That creation is not done yet. God started it and then turned it over to God's agents. At every funeral, I talk about the idea that the Hebrew word for messenger is malach, which is also the Hebrew word for angel. God has messengers. God has agents. You want to see what they look like? They don't have wings. They look like you and me. Look around the room. That's who we created in the image of God. God selected to complete the work of creation. If you think about it, God could have created a perfect world. Perfect. No war, no disease, no hunger, no poverty, no bad hair days. Perfect. Perfect. If we lived in a perfect world, what would our role be? We would literally have nothing to do. We would be the moral equivalent of lima beans. We would be decorations in God's garden, very nice, but no role. But since we're taught we're created in the divine image, there must be some significant work for us to do. Therefore, the world is not perfect. God needs us for God's most important task. There's a wonderful book by Abraham Joshua Heschel, which is called God in Search of Man. God evidently has decided or is incapable of doing the job alone. But we have free will. We can build hospitals or gas chambers. Humans are morally significant. We can do good or evil. Your dog or your goldfish can't do good or evil. They can be well-trained or not so well-trained, but they can't make moral choice. This is what's meant by B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God. So what's the purpose of the Jewish purpose in the world? Did you ever wonder why are there Jews? Why we have survived so long in spite of being universally hated? Every society which has had a significant Jewish population in it has expelled its Jews, with the single exception of the United States. Our purpose is to bring the message of God to the world. Not to convert the world to Judaism, to bring the message of ethical monotheism. That there's one God, and God's primary requirement of us is to be ethical. In a way that's redundant, because the word ethics comes from e theos, e like e pluribus unum, meaning from, and theos meaning God. God's primary concern is how we treat one another. That's the Jewish message to the world. We are to be a light to the nations, an or lagoyim, to complete creation, tikkun olam. Yes, we are chosen for this mission, but it's for an added responsibility. There's not 10 commandments given to the Jews. We count in our Torah 613 commandments, and that's just in the Torah. The rabbis, unsatisfied with a mere 613 commandments, added thousands more. Our job is to teach the world ethics, that humans are created in the divine image, and human life is sacred. The religions that came out of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, take this role for us. You know, there's 15 million Jews in the world, but roughly half of the 7 billion people in the world trace their heritage to Abraham. And it's sometimes more clear than others that our very lives depend on our succeeding in this job. We're like tightrope workers without a net. If the world is not ethical, we know from history who they come after first. Judaism is focused on how one lives one's life, not so much what you believe. This is in great distinction to other religions, which much more emphasize correct faith and belief Judaism says, you believe, you don't believe, not so important. Do the mitzvot. And Reform Judaism, liberal Judaism, stresses especially those commandments which relate to ethics, how we treat one another. The three major movements in Judaism differ on how they interpret Jewish law. In brief, Orthodoxy, Jewish law is binding on all Jews, never changes. Yes, you need new laws. What's electricity? What are the laws on Shabbat and electricity? You know, what time does an astronaut on the moon say morning prayers? All of those things aren't covered in the Torah and the Talmud. So we have new laws, but once a law is made, it never changes. Conservative Judaism, binding on all Jews, but the laws change with the time. Reform Judaism, ethical law is binding, ritual law, we can take on our, we should really examine and try and determine whether we hear God speaking to us in these rules. I hear many of my Reform friends say, I'm Reform, I don't need to do it, anything. That's not exactly the way we're supposed to teach it. My own path has been one of New Year's Jewish New Year's resolution and increased ritual observance. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between ritual and ethical. When I'm wearing my yarmulke, I have a very strong sense that people see me as a Jew and a representative of Judaism and God. And I can't be the same jerk that I was before I put on my yarmulke. Actually, wearing the yarmulke cost me a car. I had an old Volvo who I don't know what went wrong with it, but it would start smoking horribly. And the thing that got me most was here I was with my yarmulke driving around polluting the earth. It was not so good that I was polluting the earth, but it was worse that I thought people would see me and saying, there goes a serious Jewish person who doesn't care about the environment. So why is it important to be religious and Jewish? Dennis Prager and Joseph Telushkin, in a wonderful book called The Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism, present two arguments that were compelling to me and what really led me on the role of being a more serious Jew. First, they assert, and I agree with them, that without God there is no objective good or evil. You have your opinions about what's good and ethical, I have my opinions, you have your opinions, Hitler had his opinions, Stalin had his opinions, nothing that Hitler did was illegal. It was legal according to the laws of Germany. Stalin murdered 6 million Ukrainians. It was perfectly legal according to the laws of the Soviet Union. Most of us would assert, no, there are certain things that are just wrong. It doesn't matter if everybody is convinced it's okay to do them, they're just wrong. Well, if that's the case, there must be an external source to these ethics. Prager and Telushkin also assert that if the physical world, if science is the only reality, then life is ultimately purposeless. The atoms that make up your spouse, your children, your grandchildren, have no more inherent meaning than the atoms that make up this sheet of paper. This sheet of paper is composed of organic hydrocarbons. If I burn this sheet of paper, I turn a small, relatively small amount of organic hydrocarbons into water vapor and carbon dioxide. If I burn a human being alive, I turn a relatively small amount of organic hydrocarbons into carbon dioxide and water vapor. That's all the Holocaust was. If the scientific reality is the only truth, that's all the Holocaust was. The premature oxidation of a very small amount of biomass. I can't prove that that's not true. I just simply refuse to live my life as though that's true. I can't live with that. I believe being religious adds depth to meaning. While I'm not absolutely certain that God exists, I have faith, but not certainty, I am certain that my life has been made far deeper and more rewarding by my involvement in religion and Judaism. I've spent literally thousands of hours in study, in prayer, in fascinating discussions, in comforting others and being comforted by them, all as a result of my passionate involvement in Judaism. On the other hand, I've watched a lot less television. Judaism, I believe, adds holiness to life. Part of the game plan is to bring holy moments to life. A holy moment is really easy when you're standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon and you're overwhelmed with nature's beauty. But Judaism tries to get you into that moment at every moment of your life. So here's the example I love to teach, and my apologies to those of you who have heard it several times. Holiness in the supermarket. Imagine you're walking into Gelson's or whatever the best supermarket in town is. You know, there's Foster Farms, there's some really beautiful supermarkets around. And, you know, your typical experience might be, well, it's expensive, I gotta buy things, and here I go. Okay, and you rush around and you get stuff and you're schlepping it out to the car and that's your day. Now, instead, take a religious perspective. In a world where I think 40% of people don't have access to clean water, here you are in an environment where food is just spread out in front of you. In a world where many people are hungry and don't have good nutrition. In a world where history has shown that most people don't have access to good food, there it is. The cans are all lined up. If you go over to where they sell the fruits and vegetables, there's a little spritzer that spritzes mist on them. And if you listen closely, you can actually hear the thunder in some of the supermarkets. It's trying to fool the vegetables into thinking it's actually raining on them. It's amazing. Think of it as a horn of plenty, a cornucopia that God has laid at your feet. And if that's not enough, go to, and I've done this in several different places with several different things. The first one I tried was mustard in Gelson's. So go to where they sell the mustard. I, for one, would be happy if I just had deli mustard. Perfectly happy. How many kinds of mustard are there, do you think? How many choices? In a world where God not only so loves you, but gives you nutrition. God not only gives you nutrition, but gives you mustard. God not only gives you mustard, but gives you a choice. The day I did this at Gelson's, there was a choice of 39 possible selections of mustard. Coarse chopped, lean, you know, fine chopped, gray coupon, you name it. I gave the sermon a second time and I said I couldn't just stick with the mustard, so I went to Whole Foods to count olive oil. Olive oil. It's nice to have oil. It's nice to have olive oil. Okay? How many choices do you think I found for olive oil? Anybody want to guess? Yes? 52? No? Huh? Heinz. That's Heinz. 57? I counted 92 choices of olive oil. Big bottles, little bottles, flavored with this, flavored with that, virgin, extra virgin, you know, a little on the wild side. Haven't figured that out. But I didn't go over to the safflower oil or the, you know, the or any of the other oils, just olive oil. So really take a moment to think about how incredibly blessed we are. That not only do we have food to eat, but I dare say everyone in this room probably has a choice of mustard and oil. Say a bracha, or thank God. As one of my teachers, Rabbi Richard Levy, once noted, a gift without thanks, in some sense, becomes a theft. If you can take this seriously and respond with awe and gratitude, and a commitment to share what you have, that's the hook. We have lots of gifts in our life. But the gifts come with strings attached. The strings attached are the tzitzit, which we're told are there to remind us of the commandments. It's not just, gosh, how lucky I am. I live in my parents happen to have me in this community at this time in my life. But these are gifts I've been given and I have to give back. That's the difference between religious spirituality and sort of unattached spirituality. In religious spirituality, you have an obligation to give back. Bringing comfort to life. One of the deepest privileges I have as a serious Jew is the opportunity to comfort others at the time of the loss of a loved one facing an operation, in living with disease, in times of family crisis, and at the deathbed of a parent or a grandparent. In the same way, my family and I have been comforted at times of our own loss and pain. No matter how well I pray, I don't believe that God can reach into the cells of my loved ones to cure them of some disease that might be there. But I do believe that God can and does send loving friends to comfort. I believe that God can and does inspire physicians, nurses, and caregivers, and researchers to address the ills that plague my family and yours. And I know that Judaism leads me into a caring and comforting community. Our rabbis taught that we should consider the world as balanced between good and evil, and to assume that our next act will tip the balance. My experience as a comforter and comforted over the last years has taught me that there's an infinite amount of pain and an infinite amount of comfort in the world. Perhaps we should consider the world as equally balanced between pain and comfort, and our next action will tip the world toward being a place of ra, or evil, or rachamim, rachmanas, compassion. The responsibility is ours. So in the final analysis, it's hard to be certain that God exists, to be certain that the Torah, the Bible, and the Talmud are records of God in search of man, as Abraham Joshua Heschel put it. But I believe, and I choose to believe, that these things are true. I am sure, I am certain beyond all doubt, that buying into our traditions, myths, if you will, of Judaism, is scientifically and intellectually rational. And it results in a life for me, my family, the community, and the world that is measurably deeper, better, more moral, more purposeful, more comprehensible, more holy, more comforting, and more hopeful, and more beautiful, more loving, more sweet, more musical, more joyous, and more delightful in every way I can think of it. For me, this is enough. I can handle the doubt and uncertainty. Dayanim. It's enough for me. My prayer for you and for our congregation is that we will be inscribed for a good and sweet year in the Book of Life. I pray for a year of health and a year of peace. I pray that God gives us the strength to complete the task that God has given us, to repair the ills in our own lives, in the lives of our families, our communities, and the world. I pray that each of you discover, whether through these high holiday services or through other Kehilat HaAlonim services and courses and programs, the beauty and passion and intellectual challenge that is our religion and our tradition. Avotenu ve'imotenu, our fathers and our mothers, of blessed memory, spent their lives and even gave their lives in order to bless our lives with a precious gift. They have paid the price. And you, in your support of this congregation and in the time you devote to it and to Judaism, have paid a price. All that remains is that you take the time to open and fully explore the treasures that await you. L'shana tova tikateru. May you be inscribed and sealed for a good year in the Book of Life.